Certainly some must have escaped. All of the inhabitants of Asit were seldom at home. Parties roamed the desert, trekked to the towns. With a sigh of resignation, Leto put away his binoculars. He slipped down the hidden face of the dune, took extra care to dig in his stole-tent and conceal all sign of his intrusion, as he prepared to spend the hot hours. The sluggish currents of fatigue stole along his limbs as he sealed himself in the darkness. Within the tent's sweaty confines, he spent much of the day drowsing, imagining mistakes he could have made. His dreams were defensive, but there could be no self-defense in this trial he and Ganima had chosen. Failure would scald their souls. He ate spice biscuits and slept, awakened to eat once more, to drink, and return to sleep. It had been a long journey to this place, a severe test for the muscles of a child. Toward evening he awoke refreshed, listened for signs of life. He crept out of his sandy shroud. There was dust high up in the sky blowing one way, but he could feel sand stinging his cheek from another direction. Sure sign there would be a weather change. He sensed a storm coming. Cautiously, he crept to the crest of his dune, peered once more at those enigmatic rocks. The intervening air was yellow. The signs spoke of a Coriolis storm approaching, the wind that carried death in its belly. There'd be a great winding sheet of wind-driven sand that might stretch across 4 degrees of latitude. The desolate emptiness of the gypsum pan was a yellow surface now, reflecting the dust clouds. The false peace of evening enfolded him. Then the day collapsed and it was night, the quick night of the inner desert. The rocks were transformed into angular peaks frosted by the light of first moon. He felt sand thorns stinging his skin. A peal of dry thunder sounded like an echo from distant drums, and in the space between moonlight and darkness, he saw sudden movement. Bats. He could hear the stirring of their wings, their tiny squeaks. Bats. By design or accident, this place conveyed a sense of abandoned desolation. It was where the half-legendary smuggler stronghold should be, Fondak. But what if it were not Fondak? What if the taboo still ruled, and this were only the shell of ghostly Jakarutu? Leto crouched in the lee of his dune, and waited for the night to settle into its own rhythms. Patience and caution. Caution and patience. For a time he amused himself by reviewing Chaucer's route from London to Canterbury, listing the places from Southwark. 2 miles to the watering place of St. Thomas, 5 miles to Deptford, 6 miles to Greenwich, 30 miles to Rochester, 40 miles to Sittingbourne, 55 miles to Boughton under Blean, 58 miles to Harbledown, and 60 miles to Canterbury. It gave him a sense of timeless buoyancy to know that few in his universe would recall Chaucer, or know any London except the village on Gansereed. St. Thomas was preserved in the Orange Catholic Bible and the Ajar Book, but Canterbury was gone from the memories of men, as was the planet which had known it. There lay the burden of his memories, of all those lives which threatened to engulf him. He had made that trip to Canterbury once. His present trip was longer, though, and more dangerous. Presently, he crept over the dune's crest and made his way toward the moonlit rocks. He blended with shadows, slid across the crests, made no sounds that might signal his presence. The dust had gone, as it often did just before a storm, and the night was brilliant. The day had revealed no movement, but he heard small creatures hustling in the darkness as he neared the rocks. In a valley between 2 dunes, he came upon a family of jerboa which scampered away at his approach. He eased over the next crest, his emotions beset by salty anxieties. That cleft he had seen, did it lead up to an entrance? And there were other concerns. The old-time siege had always been guarded by traps, poisoned barbs in pits, poisoned spines on plants. He felt himself caught up in the Fremen Agrippa, the ear-minded night, and he listened for the slightest sound. The gray rocks towered above him now, made giant by his nearness. As he listened, he heard birds invisible in that cliff, the soft calling of winged prey. They were the sounds of day-birds, but abroad by night. What had turned their world around? Human predation? Abruptly, Leto froze against the sand. There was fire on the cliff, a ballet of glittering and mysterious gems against the night's black gauze, the sort of signal a siege might send to wanderers across the bled. Who were these occupants of this place? He crept forward into the deepest shadows at the cliff's base, felt along the rock with a hand, sliding his body behind the hand as he sought the fissure he'd seen by daylight. He located it on his 8th step, slipped the sand snorkel from his kit, and probed the darkness. As he moved, something tight and binding dropped over his shoulders and arms, immobilizing him. Trap vine! He resisted the urge to struggle. That only made the vine pull tighter. He dropped the snorkel, flexed the fingers of his right hand, trying for the knife at his waist. He felt like a bare innocent for not throwing something into that fissure from a distance, testing the darkness for its dangers. His mind had been too occupied by the fire on the cliff. Each movement tightened the trap vine, but his fingers at last touched the knife hilt. Stealthily, he closed his hand around the hilt, began to slip it free. Flaring light enveloped him, arresting all movement.
"Ah, a fine catch in our net."
It was a heavy masculine voice from behind Leto, something vaguely familiar in the tone. Leto tried to turn his head, aware of the vine's dangerous propensity to crush a body which moved too freely. A hand took his knife before he could see his captor. The hand moved expertly over his body, extracting the small devices he and Ganima carried as a matter of survival. Nothing escaped the searcher, not even the sugar wire garrote concealed in his hair. Leto still had not seen the man. Fingers did something with the trap vine, and he found he could breathe easier, but the man said,
"Do not struggle, Leto Atreides. I have your water in my cup."
By supreme effort, Leto remained calm, said, "You know my name?"
"Of course. When one baits a trap, it's for a purpose. One aims for a specific quarry, not so?"
Leto remained silent, but his thoughts whirled.
"You feel betrayed," the heavy voice said.
Hands turned him around, gently but with an obvious show of strength. An adult male was telling the child what the odds were. Leto stared up into the glare from twin floater flares, saw the black outline of a stillsuit-masked face, the hood. As his eyes adjusted, he made out a dark strip of skin, the utterly shadowed eyes of melange addiction.
"You wonder why we went to all this trouble," the man said.
His voice issued from the shielded lower part of his face with a curious muffled quality, as though he tried to conceal an accent.
"I long ago ceased to wonder at the numbers of people who want the Atreides twins dead," Leto said. "Their reasons are obvious."
As he spoke, Leto's mind flung itself against the unknown as against a cage, questing wildly for answers. A baited trap? But who had known except Ganima? Impossible! Ganima wouldn't betray her own brother. Then did someone know him well enough to predict his actions? Who? His grandmother? How could she?
"You could not be permitted to go on as you were," the man said. "Very bad. Before ascending the throne, you need to be educated."
The whiteless eyes stared down at him.
"You wonder how one could presume to educate such a person as yourself? You, with the knowledge of a multitude held there in your memories? That's just it, you see. You think yourself educated, but all you are is a repository of dead lives. You don't yet have a life of your own. You're just a walking surfeit of others, all with one goal, to seek death. Not good in a ruler, being a death-seeker. You'd strew your surroundings with corpses. Your father, for example, never understood that
you dare speak of him that way.
Many's the time I've dared it. He was only Paul Atreides, after all. Well, boy, welcome to your school."
The man brought a hand from beneath his robe, touched Leto's cheek. Leto felt the jolt of a slapshot, and found himself winding downward into a darkness where a green flag waved. It was the green banner of the Atreides, with its day and night symbols, its dune staff which concealed a water tube. He heard the water gurgling as unconsciousness enfolded him. Or was it someone chuckling? We can still remember the golden days before Heisenberg, who showed humans the walls enclosing our predestined arguments. The lives within me find this amusing. Knowledge, you see, has no uses without purpose, but purpose is what builds enclosing walls. Leto Atreides II, his voice. Alia found herself speaking harshly to the guards she confronted in the temple foyer. There were 9 of them in the dusty green uniforms of the suburban patrol, and they were still panting and sweating with their exertions. The light of late afternoon came in the door behind them. The area had been cleared of pilgrims.
"So my orders mean nothing to you?" she demanded.
And she wondered at her own anger, not trying to contain it, but letting it run. Her body trembled with unleashed tensions. Idaho gone. The Lady Jessica. No reports. Only rumors that they were on Seleucia. Why hadn't Idaho sent a message? What had he done? Had he learned finally about Javid? Alia wore the yellow of Arakeen mourning, the color of the burning sun from Fremen history. In a few minutes, she would be leading the second and final funeral procession to Old Gap, there to complete the stone marker for her lost nephew. The work would be completed in the night, fitting homage to one who'd been destined to lead Fremen. The priestly guards appeared defiant in the face of her anger, not shamed at all. They stood in front of her, outlined by the waning light. The odor of their perspiration was easily detected through the light and inefficient stillsuits of city dwellers. Their leader, a tall blonde Kaza with the Borkus symbols of the Cade Lamb family, flung his tilsuit mask aside to speak more clearly. His voice was full of the prideful intonations to be expected from a scion of the family which once had ruled at Sich Abir.
"Certainly we tried to capture him."
The man was obviously outraged at her attack.
"He speaks blasphemy. We know your orders, but we heard him with our own ears."
"And you failed to catch him,"
Alia said, her voice low and accusing. One of the other guards, a short young woman, tried to defend them.
"The crowds were thick there. I swear people interfered with us."
"We'll keep after him," the Cade Lamb said. "We'll not always fail."
Alia scowled.
"Why won't you understand and obey me?"
"My lady, we—"
"What will you do, scion of Cade Lamb, if you capture him and find him to be, in truth, my brother?"
He obviously did not hear her special emphasis on his name, although he could not be a priestly guard without some education and the wit to go with it. Did he want to sacrifice himself? The guardsman swallowed, then,
"We must kill him ourselves, for he breeds disorder."
The others stood aghast at this, but still defiant. They knew what they had heard.
"He calls upon the tribes to band against you," the Cade Lamb said.
Alia knew how to handle him now. She spoke in a quiet, matter-of-fact tone.
"I see. Then if you must sacrifice yourself this way, taking him openly for all to see who you are and what you do, then I guess you must."
"Sacrifice my—"
He broke off, glanced at his companions. As Kaza of this group, their appointed leader, he had the right to speak for them, but he showed signs that he wished he'd remained silent. The other guards stirred uncomfortably. In the heat of the chase, they'd defied Alia. One could only reflect now upon such defiance of the womb of heaven. With obvious discomfort, the guards opened a small space between themselves and their Kaza.
"For the good of the church, our official reaction would have to be severe," Alia said. "You understand that, don't you?"
"But he—"
"I've heard him myself," she said. "But this is a special case."
"He cannot be Muad'Dib, my lady."
"How little you know," she thought.
She said,
"We cannot risk taking him in the open, harming him where others could see it. If another opportunity presents itself, of course."
"He's always surrounded by crowds these days."
"Then I fear you must be patient. Of course, if you insist on defying me—"
She left the consequences hanging in the air, unspoken, but well understood. The Cade Lamb was ambitious, a shining career before him.
"We didn't mean defiance, my lady."
The man had himself under control now.
"We acted hastily, I can see that. Forgive us, but he—"
"Nothing has happened, nothing to forgive," she said, using the common Fremen formula.
It was one of the many ways a tribe kept peace in its ranks, and this Cade Lamb was still old Fremen enough to remember that. His family carried a long tradition of leadership. Guilt was the Naib's whip, to be used sparingly. Fremen served best when free of guilt or resentment. He showed his realization of her judgment by bowing his head, saying,
"For the good of the tribe, I understand."
"Go refresh yourselves," she said. "The procession begins in a few minutes."
"Yes, my lady."
They bustled away, every movement revealing their relief at this escape. Within Alia's head, a bass rumbled,
"Ah, you handled that most adroitly. One or two of them still believe you desire the preacher dead. They'll find a way."
"Shut up," she hissed. "Shut up. I should never have listened to you. Look what you've done."
"Set you on the road to immortality," the bass voice said.
She felt it echoing in her skull like a distant ache, thought,
"Where can I hide? There's no place to go."
"Ghanima's knife is sharp," the Baron said. "Remember that."
Alia blinked. Yes, that was something to remember. Ghanima's knife was sharp. That knife might yet cut them out of their present predicament.
If you believe certain words, you believe their hidden arguments. When you believe something is right or wrong, true or false, you believe the assumptions in the words which express the arguments. Such assumptions are often full of holes, but remain most precious to the convinced.
The Open-Ended Proof from the Panoplia Prophetica. Leto's mind floated in a stew of fierce odors,